and this is a Small World Radio production.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
Welcome to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons. I hope you're enjoying your morning. You've got your cup of coffee, you've cracked open the papers, and you've turned on WBAI 99.5 FM. So thanks for joining me this morning. Each week, City Watch brings you conversations about our city, the people that make it run, and the people running for office, the communities, the characters that make up those communities, and the politics and the policies that shape our lives. Since the pandemic began over a year ago, we have focused much of our attention on health issues, exploring the impact that COVID-19 has had on our economy, on business, on our schools, and on our daily lives. We have watched the joblessness rate rise, businesses fall. Even as opportunities for vaccinations become more widely available, the death rate still remains at a high level here in the city. On Friday, I'm not sure if you had read this, but on Friday, 58 more New Yorkers died from coronavirus. That included 35 here in New York City. But just this weekend, it was announced that anyone 50 or older, that would mean I would qualify now, anyone 50 or older can now walk in without an appointment at any city-run site to get vaccinated. This had earlier been offered for those, I think it was 70 or 75 years old or older, but now it is 50 or older. You can now walk in without an appointment at any city-run site to get vaccinated. I realize it is a personal choice, and among our listeners, there are a number of people who do not believe in vaccinations. But I also worry about our health, your health, and the fact that the virus is still mutating and there are still recent discoveries of more contagious variants across the globe and here in the country. I also do worry about misinformation that is out there, who we listen to, where we get the information that we trust, and trust is an important word, who we trust as credible sources. I've mentioned before that I do watch multiple TV shows so I could hear different political observations. I read both liberal and conservative publications. We just finished a presidency where it was clear that depending on what you watched, you either believed that at the outset of this virus it was under control and there was nothing to worry about, or you felt this was an imminent threat and we needed to act quickly or more quickly to rein in this virus and ultimately save more lives. Just a few days ago, Fox host Tucker Carlson said that perhaps the COVID-19 vaccine doesn't work and they're simply not telling you that. This despite clinical trials, and to which Dr. Anthony Fauci responded, calling it a, quote, crazy conspiracy theory. So when we think about distortions and falsehoods and lies, then at what point do they become dangerous, especially if we're not able to easily decipher fact from fiction? And if these words then lead to harmful action, then should there be some type of a sanction? That brings me to my first guest this morning, Cass Sunstein, currently the Robert Walmsley University Professor at Harvard University. He's the founder and director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy at Harvard Law School. In 2018, he received the Holberg Prize from the government of Norway, which has sometimes been described as the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for Law and the Humanities. He's the author of dozens of books, including some I'm sure that you've heard of, like Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, How Change Happens, and Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. His newest book, it's called Liars, Falsehoods and Free Speech in the Age of Deception by Oxford University Press. And in it, he explores how we should think about false speech in the modern era, and in particular, when we consider the protections that exist under the First Amendment. In Liars, Falsehoods, and Free Speech in the Age of Deception, he explores these issues with a creative and rich set of perspectives. So I invited him on the show today, onto City Watch, to talk a little about this and where we stand as a nation right now. Professor Sunstein, thanks so much for joining me here this morning on WBAI. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So starting off, it is clear how timely this book is, given how over the last 4 years, phrases like fake news and alternative facts became the norm. But in this last year, as you worked on the book, lying had deadly consequences. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So in the last few years, the omnipresence of falsehoods, sometimes lies, meaning intentional falsehoods, has become clearer, I think, than ever. The presence of lies about politics, about individuals, that's all over the place, and they can spread to a lot of people in a hurry. I finished the book during the early stages of the pandemic, and it was clear that lies are endangering health. They might be lies about the source of the virus. They might be lies about the existence of the virus. They might be lies about responses to the virus. And these are not just, you know, hyperbolically speaking, dangerous. These are literally dangerous. They can and they have cost lives.
And you consider Fox News. I just mentioned Tucker Carlson. I know there's been similar criticisms of Sean Hannity and certain hosts and how they responded to the pandemic. You know, one word you had talked about in the book was the word trust. It's who we trust, where we trust to get our information. Considering Fox News, I mean, how harmful would you say were their distortions or falsehoods?
On a scale of 1 to 10, when 10 is most harmful and 1 is not harmful at all, the answer would not be 1. Was worse than that. It is the case that individuals are either saying sincerely what they believe or trying to promote their show or trying to get attention. One host, Sean Hannity, said some things that the evidence suggests were indeed harmful in February and early March. So there's evidence suggesting that people who were listening to him and watching him, what he said mattered, and they changed their behavior relatively late. Tucker Carlson was different. He was more emphatic early on that this was a real problem, and it looked like the evidence suggests that Carlson's viewers were safer than Hannity's viewers, which suggests that lies, well, in this case, I wouldn't want to say lies. I'd say falsehoods really have an impact.
So what was very interesting for me, and I kept coming back to in the second chapter, I want to say the criteria, the grid, which looks at certain factors. You know, I think it's good to note what we should consider when someone lies. And then I guess you lay out how to determine what actions, if any, should be taken based on this grid. Can you just talk a little about the grid? Because that is something that I encourage our listeners, if they pick up Liars, to study this, because that really helps to assess the level of possible harm. Can you talk about that grid?
Great. Thank you for that. I should say that this chapter, which is my favorite in the book, was added late because a friend of mine read the book and said, hey, Cass, you need a framework. You don't have a framework here. Put in the framework. And I said, I don't know what the framework is. And he said, well, do a little work. And the value of it, if there is some, is that it helps break the logjam, I think, between those who think freedom of speech, freedom of speech, freedom of speech, bless them, and those who think danger, exclamation point, bless them too. And the framework attempts to break the logjam by saying we're concerned about four things, just four. It's not that complicated. First, what's the state of the mind of the speaker? Is it an innocent mistake where you say, for example, I think that this chemical is safe when it's actually dangerous? That's really different from saying that, you know, some politician or some friend is a criminal, That wouldn't be a very friendly thing to say about a friend, but if you say it intentionally, that's a lot worse than an innocent mistake. So the first is the state of the mind of the speaker. The second is the magnitude of the harm. If you say something like, Jack Kennedy was never president, he was actually vice president, that's false, but it's harmless. If you say that you take the Moderna vaccine, you'll be dead within 8 hours, that's harmful. That's going to actually cause death in the guise of preventing death. The third factor is the likelihood of the harm. Is it 1 in 100 or is it 99 in 100? That really matters. If you say something that only with some small chance is going to cause harm, probably let freedom ring. If you say something that with 99 in 100% chance is going to cause harm, like falsely crying fire in a crowded theater, that's a very different story. And the last question really is the imminence of harm. Is it going to happen tomorrow or is it going to happen in 2 months? If it's going to happen in 2 months, there's a good chance that we can all talk it through a little bit and maybe calm people down or maybe get the story straight. But if it's going to happen this afternoon and it is, let's say, big magnitude harm, then the argument for restricting the speech or deterring the speech is a lot stronger. So just four factors: the state of the mind of the speaker, the magnitude of the harm, the likelihood of the harm, and the timing of the harm. And the hope is that if we start thinking about those questions, then the big abstractions about freedom and danger start to recede and we're talking productively.
And you ask early on, is there a right to lie about a pandemic, health, or safety in a free society? Isn't it a constitutional right to be able to lie when you consider freedom of speech?
We're really at the frontiers now. In 2012, the Supreme Court said, in an era that seems so Britney Spears, meaning someone who was really famous back then, we wish her well, but she's not what she was in 2012. 2012, the Supreme Court said there's no ministry of truth, that if a politician says, I won the Congressional Medal of Honor, when they didn't, that's protected by the free speech principle. At the same time, the court has said that if you knowingly lie about someone in order to damage their reputation and succeed in that, that's not protected by the free speech principle. There's some space for libel law. So the tension between allowing in 2012 someone to say, I got this fantastic medal when I didn't, and forbidding people from saying that that person is a drug dealer when you know that person isn't a drug dealer, that's a big tension. I suggest that the way to make progress on the question of whether falsehood is protected is to ask about four questions. So if you say something like, I think climate change isn't real, go for it. Let freedom win out and let's have a talk. If you say this product, if you buy it, you will never get heart disease, when in fact what the product does is give you heart disease, that's false advertising, it's fraud, and that's regulable.
And we're just in this age where it seems so much easier to lie and to have that lie spread more quickly and widely through doctored videos, social media. Where do we stand right now as a nation? You know, I'd love for our listeners to have a few takeaways from this and how to better scrutinize also lies and determine for themselves what is the truth.
Okay, well, where we stand is on a precipice, and the question is what we're going to do about it. Here's something that I think it's good for all of us to keep in mind. The first is, if you hear something that's false, I'm going to say something false right now. Tiger Woods just retired. I just said something false. I told you it was false before I told you it, and I told you it was false after I told you it. Still, for many of us, including probably me, there's going to be a little voice in my head and in your head saying, did Tiger Woods retire on April 18th, 2021? I heard that. And this is an innocuous example, I think, but the problem is it's called truth bias. It means if you're told something that's false, even if you're told in real time that it's false, you tend to remember it and to remember it as true even long after. So the human mind tends, other things being equal, to credit what it hears. And that suggests if you hear something about a politician or about a state or about a pandemic, even if you're told in real time that it's false, it tends to have an insidious and significant effect on how your mind goes. Watch out for that, all of us. The second thing is that falsehoods tend to spread more rapidly than truths. It's not clear exactly why. It may be because they're more vivid and jarring and kind of scary frequently, and that's the driver of the comparative power of falsehoods. But it does suggest that social media companies need to be really careful in resorting to homilies about how the best remedy for speech is more speech. It may be that because of truth bias and the comparatively greater power of the falsehood, the truth can't catch up with a lie.
I'm glad you mentioned that about social media, because you do lay out the policies in the book as well, which was very informative. I don't want our listeners to get to the end without going through those policies as well. You'll learn a lot more. What is the responsibility that social media, say Facebook or Twitter, what responsibility do they have to censor or to respond when there is a clear falsehood or a lie on social media?
I think their first responsibility really is to protect freedom on their platforms. That's the kind of headline news that they need to do that. The second is that when you have an intentional lie that threatens with high probability to create very serious harm tomorrow, they should take it down. If they have something that threatens with pretty high probability to cause catastrophic harm the day after tomorrow, and it's an intentional falsehood, take it down. If it's an innocent statement that turns out to be false, let's say about when Columbus came to the United States or about some scientific question, leave it up. The responsibility is to allow a lot of discussion. So once we think about magnitude, imminence, timing of harm, and the state of the mind of the speaker, then we, that is to say those of us who engage with social media platforms and social media platforms themselves, can distinguish the easy cases for take it down from the easy cases for keep it up from the cases where reasonable people can differ.
You also talk about counter speech. Is counter speech not the right remedy?
It generally is, but we say this with fear and trembling rather than with confidence and full conviction. So if someone says, let's say, about the structure of the ozone layer, they say that that's actually a myth, that the ozone layer is impervious to chlorofluorocarbons, it's crazy talk. The right remedy really is to keep talking about that rather than to censor that false claim about the science. But when I say fear and trembling, if someone says about you or about any one of you out there something horrible, like that you are, engaged with terrorists or involved with criminal activity of a truly grotesque sort, and you say, actually, that's false, that's not going to be a full remedy. And insofar as each of us is deeply vulnerable, whether we're public figures or not, to a devastation from a falsehood, it is insufficient comfort to say that we can respond by saying that's not true. In fact, the very statement that's not true might amplify the force of the lie by drawing people's attention to it. They may be making people think, why would he deny it if it weren't so? Why would he bother? So that is a real cautionary note about counter speech responses to falsehoods. Still, the first remedy is talk it out.
And we've got just about 2 minutes left. Near the end of the book, you note that in life and politics, truth matters. Where do you see this going? As we experience more lies, is this hurting our society more, or are we becoming more astute and then questioning what is presented to us so we're becoming better learners?
I think the answer to the first question, is it hurting us? The answer is a lot. Where your point early, before we actually started talking about health and safety, is the most vivid. So it's all very well, and it's really good to talk about freedom of speech. But if you have, let's say, 200 people dead because of falsehoods about some health-related matter, that's a tragedy, and that's not an abstraction. So it's really causing damage, and we all need to think what to do about it. I think our law needs to be reassessed, and including our constitutional law, not radically, but it needs to be reassessed, and the practices of social media platforms and website operators, those need to be reassessed. Are we getting more astute? That's also a great question, and I've learned from my empirical co-authors to answer that question by saying it's an empirical question. We don't have the data. So probably the most reliable thing to say is there's a lot of diversity out there where all of us sometimes feel when we see a falsehood, oh, maybe that's true. Or all of us have heard from friends and family something crazily preposterous that they actually believe, and they tell us that crazy preposterous thing, which is an anecdotal way of saying there's a lot of difference out there where some people are astute and cautious and other people are credulous. And some of us are astute about some things and credulous about others. And what we're astute about and what we're credulous about often depends on what we want to believe. So if we want to believe something, we might think, sure, even though it's false. And if we don't, we might want to say, you've got to be kidding, even though it's true.
And as we wrap up, Professor Kassenstein, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and liars, falsehoods, and free speech in the age of deception?
Thank you so much for that. And I'm conscious that because of the topic of my book, I have to be super truthful here. The book Liars is available on online sellers, if we can say that. Plenty of independent bookstores have the book with the simple name Liars. And for me, if you put my name in Google, you will find my Harvard website, which is mostly truthful, and you will find a lot of falsehoods about me.
Professor Kassenstein, thank you so much for joining me here this morning on WBAI.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
If you just tuned in, you've been listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. This is City Watch. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons, and I was just talking with Kassenstein, currently the Robert Walmsley University professor at Harvard, and his new book is called Liars, Falsehoods, and Free Speech in the Age of Deception by Oxford University Press. So as regular listeners know, my co-host David Brand and I alternate weekends since the pandemic began. We each have topics we like to explore, such as the environment, sports. Okay, that one's David's. Social justice and the state of our city. And amid the pandemic, issues about our health and our safety, education of our kids, and the economic future of our city are at the fore. We have witnessed considerable losses. Our neighbors, friends, and coworkers have lost their jobs. Many face the prospect of losing their homes. As a reporter at the Daily News, Post, and New York One, I always felt I was helping the average New Yorker whenever I could illustrate the challenges they faced. And often, especially when I was at New York One, tenants would come to me asking for help when they were facing problems with their landlords, both private or public ones. It was just incredible, the response whenever I would talk with a tenant advocate for a story, and often it would lead to some type of a resolution. So with that, I want to get to my next guest, former New York City Council member Dan Gorodnick. He helped lead the tenants of Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village in an unsuccessful attempt to purchase, or in the attempt rather, to purchase the complexes from MetLife. They were unsuccessful, the tenants, at that point. But there's this is an amazing story. That fight had not ended with the sale. And now Dan Gorodnick is pulling back the curtain on all that took place before and after that sale with his new book, Saving Stuyvesant Town, How One Community Defeated the Worst Real Estate Deal in History. It's published by Three Hills, an imprint of Cornell University Press. And former councilman Dan Gorodnick joins me here this morning on WBAI. Welcome.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks very much for having me.
So in good dramas, heroes are pitted against villains. Who are the heroes here, and who are or were the villains?
Well, that's right. I think that the first category of heroes here have to be the Tenants Association of Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village. You know, this was a community which saw incredible turmoil over an entire decade. And they found ways to not only push back, but to organize and keep people informed and to find ways to become viable commercial actors, somebody who real estate entities might think to partner with, which itself is an extraordinary feat. I would say other pivotal players who played a positive role here, Senior Senator Chuck Schumer was incredibly helpful to the tenants. He was there at every step of the way. Mayor de Blasio was helpful when he came into office. He saw fit to support the tenants and give lift to our efforts to not only organize but deliver a good outcome. And then, there were players who, did not need to be helpful, the special servicer that represented the lenders after an incredible default in 2010. That actually helped us achieve our goals. And so, as people reading the book, we'll see that there are some surprises in there as to who comes out as a supporter, or at least, if not a hero, but an important player in the equation. In terms of villains, not a whole lot of good things to say about MetLife's efforts in Stuyvesant Town in 2006. They had a deal in the 1940s with the city of New York to build Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village, and it was one which guaranteed a certain rate of return and allowed for the condemnation of an entire community of people. But then in 2006, at the height of the real estate market, they decided to turn their backs on the tenants who lived there and to just sell the property to the highest bidder. And, of course, the winner of that bid, which was Tishman Speyer and BlackRock, also do not fare particularly well in this story because their entire business plan was premised on the idea that they could get tenants, existing tenants, who were covered by rent protections out of their apartments as quickly as possible to raise revenues and to be able to pay back their debts.
So, I talked to a friend who had lived in Stuyvesant Town who then moved to Peter Cooper, still lives there now, and she was not familiar. And it was not familiar to me as well about the origins of Stuyvesant Town, that you note how embedded racism was in the original deal. As you say, its roots were, quote, planted in bitter soil. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I think it's really important for people to recognize this on a variety of levels. And the first level is that it has a horrible history in its origins. MetLife, when they were working with Robert Moses and Fiorella LaGuardia and penned a deal in 1943 to build Stuyvesant Town, and it was a deal that allowed for the displacement, first of all, of about 11,000 people who lived in the neighborhood, mostly poor immigrants, who were sent packing without any commitment that either there would be a place for them to go to or a place that they could afford to return. And MetLife, when the community was built and they opened their doors, decided that it would only make rental opportunities available to white people, which prompted one of the city's most significant civil rights housing battles, where the residents, the new residents, played a pivotal role in forcing MetLife to recant and to reverse that policy of denying the opportunity for black residents to live there. In fact, some of the people, the new residents, the white residents of Stuytown, invited black people to come and live with them as a way to integrate the community and to try to stay within the bounds of MetLife rules as a way to force their hand. It became a citywide effort, and it was the sort of a movement which resulted in change in local law when New York City changed the rules and said that properties like this, developments like this, could no longer exclude people on the basis of their race in future development opportunities like this one.
So you had basically just started your first term in office, only about 6 months in, when you learned that your childhood home, and as you note, a home to about a fifth of your constituents, was up for sale. How soon did you come to realize you know, how flawed this whole arrangement was. I know we won't have much time, and it's very detailed. There's lots of chapters here to go through. I'd love for you to talk just a little about the acquisition and what it would have meant, could have meant to tenants when Tishman Speyer had taken control.
When Tishman Speyer came in and with BlackRock, it became clear almost overnight that they intended to take whatever steps that they could to try to move rent-stabilized tenants out of their apartments. And they mostly used a tool that existed in New York state law called vacancy decontrol. So people who enjoyed protections on their rent, so their rent couldn't go up by more than a certain amount every year as defined by a governmental board, those people were an obstacle to Tishman Speyer to getting rents up. But when those units became vacant, either because somebody left or if they died, there was an opportunity in the law to take that apartment out of rent stabilization. So people who were there were the primary obstacle to Tishman Speyer and BlackRock to paying back their debts and raising the revenues as they planned to do. So what we saw almost immediately was legal notices being filed against people claiming that they were not properly occupying their rent stabilized unit for one reason or another, one allegation or another. And it created an immediate culture of fear and concern in the neighborhood. And we pushed back, obviously, which is one of the stories that we tell in the book. If the tenants, and you noted in your intro that the tenants themselves put together a bid to try to buy Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village when it went up for that sale in 2006, we were competing with Tishman Speyer and BlackRock and everybody else in the real estate world. And we put together a $4.5 billion bid ourselves to try to buy the community and to preserve it as affordable housing and to give people an opportunity to own their apartments. And I think that the most obvious difference would have been immediate stability in 2006. People would have had a chance to become homeowners. We would not have overpaid for the property and not had the leverage that Tishman Speyer and BlackRock did. And we also were planning on putting restrictions on resale of those apartments so that they would be available for middle-class people in perpetuity. And that was a really important point to us all along, which was the preservation of this middle-class community as a middle-class community. And that is what I think you would have seen if the tenants had come out on top in 2006.
You've been listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons, and I'm talking with former New York City Councilmember Dan Gorodnick, the author of Saving Stuyvesant Town, How One Community Defeated the Worst Real Estate Deal in History, published by Three Hills, an imprint of Cornell University Press. I'm glad you talked about the tenants, because that's where I wanted to go next. What resonated throughout the book was a constant engagement of tenants. You wrote that they were taking control of their destiny and fighting back against big real estate. For anyone else out there who is listening, what are some of the lessons that you learned about, you know, tenant advocacy that they can take away from this, particularly if they're also facing challenges and do want to act similarly?
I think that there is a key lesson. I do think that this book can serve as a blueprint for other communities that are on the brink, because, you know, Stuyvesant Town may have been the biggest and most prominent example of such a thing, but there are plenty of communities where regulatory agreements are expiring or tax abatements are expiring, where people need to organize and be ready for when that happens. I think that the biggest lesson and the biggest takeaway is, how do you create some leverage in a situation where you really have none? In this situation, the city had no official hook to force MetLife, Tishman Speyer, CW Capital, anybody to do anything. The tenants, certainly had no right to force anybody to do anything. But through years of advocacy and making a political statement and building political support, not only from our local elected officials, but more broadly around the city, where this became an issue of citywide concern. Ultimately, through our efforts, getting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two quasi-public entities, to agree to not lend in any deal in Stuyvesant Town unless that deal had the support of the tenants and the city was an extraordinary point of leverage for us, which allowed us to not only, through our advocacy and noise, drive down the possible value of the property if we were not involved, but we also were able to drive up the cost of lending and borrowing if we were not endorsing the deal. So I think the big picture point is trying to find those pressure points to give tenants an opportunity to advocate for themselves, even where it looks like there may be no obvious hooks for them to do so. And that's what we were able to do, I think, so effectively with the Tenants Association of Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper.
So we've got just about 2 minutes left, and, you know, I've got a ton of questions, but I want to squeeze in two quick ones. You know, was there something that, as you went back and relived this, was there something that surprised you, something you learned that you had not known while you were in office?
Yeah, I think the biggest one for me was when you are right in the middle of such a battle where your neighbors are against the wall and being displaced and where they're fighting back for their lives, you don't necessarily see the big picture. And it's not always so easy to take a step back and say, wait a minute, not only is this affecting my residents and my neighbors here, but it's also a citywide issue. It's also a national issue. The investors in Stuyvesant Town included everybody from, you know, the pension funds of California and Florida and the government of Singapore and the Church of England and everyone in between. And the size and scale of this was big, obviously, for New York City, but it also is and was the biggest residential real estate deal in American history. Its biggest default, and what we ultimately ended up, you know, spoiler alert here, striking, was the largest affordable housing deal in New York City's history. So the size and the scale and the importance of what we were doing was something which, you know, we knew was important to ourselves and to our neighbors. But I think when I took a step back to put it in a broader context, it was much clearer to me as to how important and how precedent-setting and how critical it was for people who were watching this all around the country, were able to take things away from what we were doing right there.
And because I did not mention it at the outset of this interview, I'd love for our listeners who are familiar with your work in government, I'd love for them to know what you're up to right now. What are you doing these days?
Sure. Well, I am the president and CEO of the Riverside Park Conservancy, which is a not-for-profit that supports 6 miles of public space along the west side of Manhattan. So whereas my city council district was the east side of Manhattan, I am now running a not-for-profit that supports a good chunk of the west side of Manhattan. And it is a great and exciting continuation of life in public service. And I hope people spend some time enjoying Riverside Park this summer. We've got some great things happening, including a park-wide public art show that will start on June the 5th.
Else, anyone who's listening out there, where can they go to learn more about you and about saving Stuyvesant Town, how one community defeated the worst real estate deal in history?
Well, they can go to my website at dangorodnick.com. Obviously, they can also look up Saving Stuyvesant Town anywhere they buy their books. So I do not want to prescribe that specifically. I know people have different preferences, but you can find it everywhere you would find your most favorite books, and I hope people will enjoy it, and I appreciate the opportunity, Jeff, to talk about this important story.
Dan Gorodnick, thank you so much for joining me here on WBAI Today.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
So you've been listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons, and I was just talking with former New York City Council member Dan Gorodnick about his book, Saving Stuyvesant Town. This weekend, we reached a sad benchmark that speaks to the lingering presence of COVID in our world. We may be seeing a leveling off of new cases in some areas with the greater availability of vaccines, but worldwide, the death toll to COVID-19 surpassed, I believe it's 3 million on Saturday, and in some cities worldwide, morgues are overflowing, and there are hot spots in Eastern Europe, in Latin America, in Asia. The New York Times reported that the global rate of deaths is just accelerating. You know, by no means are we out of the woods yet or nearing that point. And it gives us reason for pause to consider what we can still safely do, but also a reason to reflect on the loss of livelihoods and lives we've borne witness to over this past year. I've lost some friends and former colleagues and neighbors, and years from now, I wonder who and what I'm going to remember most about this time. The earliest days, which were very frightening, the isolation, the inability to visit people who were hospitalized, the friends who lost their jobs. There's a new film coming out. It debuts this week that adapts real stories, real memories from residents of Queens as they reflect on their lives over this past year. It's called I See You and You See Me, and it was the first production of its type by Queens Theatre. And on screen, you will see real actors, some you may recognize from stage and screen, presenting those accounts. So joining me this morning to talk about the film is acclaimed writer and director Harris Duran, whose previous works include Beauty Mark and The Story of Milo and Annie, the satirical web series The Ivanka Diaries, and the narrative documentary This Movie Will Get Into Sundance, among a number of other works. And he's now in pre-production on his next feature, Atticus Brown Is Still Here. Harris Duran, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you for having me.
Before I get to the film itself, I'd love our listeners to just know a little more about you and your film career. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I'm Harris Duran, born and raised in Queens, in a little part of Queens called Electchester, which is Fresh Meadows. And I was an actor for a long time. I went to high school performing arts, and then I went to Juilliard. Now I'm a filmmaker, and as you said, I made a movie called Beauty Mark that, you know, did really well at festivals and everyone can watch on Amazon and iTunes and everything. And I've been developing a bunch of new works that are exciting, and I was thrilled to be able to work on this piece for Queens Theatre, you know, at a time where so much had stopped. You know, the ability to actually, like, create art in these extreme circumstances, I think was really important to all of the artists involved, and so it was a real blessing to be able to do.
This is the first time Queens Theatre has done a project like this. How did this film originate, and how did you become part of it?
Sure. So I met Dominic D'Andrea, who works at Queens Theatre and is the head of online programming. He and I actually met on a Zoom during the pandemic because they were, what are you going to do? And so we actually met in a, you know, a friend's Zoom and connected and stayed in touch. And Dominic had the idea of doing something with, there were all of these oral histories that had been given to Queens Memory Project, which is part of Queens Library, to just document people's stories in Queens over the years. And he had an idea of taking the ones that people submitted during the pandemic and doing something with them artistic. And so he, because my background is both theater and film, and I'm from Queens, he thought that I might be a good person to take these stories and figure out how to do something with them, you know, so that they would be able to continue to, you know, provide, you know, art to the people that go to Queens Theatre. And so that was where it came about.
And so talk about your vision as, you know, you adapted the stories, you know, you wrote this, directed this, adapted those stories. Talk a little about your vision.
Sure. So the Memory Project is enormous. They're doing amazing work over there. And so there were so many stories to go through. And so I ended up reading and listening to so many different accounts of people's experiences during the pandemic. And what I was seeing was that everyone's experience was actually very different, you know, that people, you know, everyone was stuck in their apartments, you know, but what were they doing and how were they experiencing it? And, you know, did they have, you know, like 10 young children that they're taking care of, or are they isolated and alone? And that experience is very different for everyone. And I started to realize that what everyone had in common is that we were all having a shared experience together. you know, whether that is something, you know, that was chaotic or isolated. It's, you know, no one was in this alone, you know, and that was sort of the takeaway that I got and what I felt like was really emotional and important to this time, because the stories that I was using were from the beginning of the pandemic when, you know, we didn't really know what was going on. So you're talking March, April, May, that's when the stories are from. You know, and Queens was, you know, the hotspot of, you know, the entire country, of where it was, you know, the epicenter of the epicenter. And, you know, I think it's really important that those stories be heard and remembered. And you know, it's a chance to reflect, even though we're actually still going in the middle of it, hopefully towards the end of it. But, yeah, I think it's, you know, so much has changed in just a year, to be able to see what people were going through, to have, you know, a little like peekaboo into people's windows and to see what they were experiencing, I think is really valuable and enlightening.
And, you know, obviously many movies, TV shows, you know, had to just rethink how they could continue during the pandemic. I'm curious how the pandemic affected how you put together the film, how the film was shot.
Sure. So we ended up shooting in August, which, you know, was still, you know, the pandemic was raging. And we ended up shooting some of the pieces in the theater. There are three beautiful theaters at Queen's Theater. And so it was me and my cinematographer. It was just us, you know, in the theater, basically in hazmat suits, filming different actors one at a time in different spaces to make sure that they weren't, you know, taking off their mask and speaking out loud, you know, in the same space on the same day, you know, because no one really knew, you know, the ins and outs of like how to spread it. And so we were just being extra cautious, you know, and, you know, these are very large spaces. So we knew that, you know, as long as you were very far spaced out and that me and my cinematographer were completely covered, we'd be okay. So some people were filmed in the theaters and some were, you know, filmed social distance and some were filmed virtually. And in that variety of filming experiences, you end up having a film that, you know, it's like a film theater hybrid that each piece looks and feels different. And so you really feel like you're entering a new world with each piece. And each piece has a different point of view, you know, a really different experience. So I think people really get a sense of like something holistic that was occurring at the time.
And, you know, I've seen the film. I encourage people to make a point to tune in, and we'll give the website where to go to in just a few moments. You know, these stories resonate. And obviously, you know, when you sifted through stories to see which ones you could adapt for this, what did you look for and what did the stories that you selected, what did they speak to?
Sure. I mean, I looked for, you know, my experience growing up in Queens is, you know, everyone lives in Queens. You know, it's like such an extremely diverse place in every sense of the word. And so it was important to me to have stories and a cast that really reflected the world that I knew, which is a really diverse world, you know, in terms of like racially, religion, in terms of, you know, how much money people have or not, education, you know, all the different aspects. And so I really wanted to see different points of view and allow for those points of view to be heard. And so that's really what I was looking for, of like really distinct, unique points of view and experiences, things that people, you know, don't know about, you know, that you really get this opportunity to see into someone else's world, you know, from, you know, an Iranian Jewish woman who has never made Passover before because, you know, her parents always did it. And so she has to like learn how to make a Passover for her son, to, you know, so someone who has experienced COVID and what that was like actually going through it, to someone who's just like, what do you do about dating? Do you know what I mean? Of where, like, everyone's has different experiences and just, you know, there's still, you know, there's traumatic life happening and there's also, like, regular life trying to find, figure out how to continue. And so sometimes that's just, how do you do online dating? And so there's a real variety of stories in this that I think show how different everyone's experiences were under the umbrella of, you know, all having this, like, shared extreme experience.
And in our final minute or two, can you just tell our listeners a little more about what you're up to next? Where can people expect to see some of your work moving ahead?
Sure. So I have a bunch of films that are being developed right now, and so you can look out for those in the near future. But one thing I did over the pandemic was there's a stage musical I wrote called Bleeding Love that has been developed for years. That's about, you know, a world where it's too dangerous to go outside, so everyone's cloistered in their apartment. And so at the beginning of the pandemic, we got a bunch of Broadway stars together to record this. It's like Sarah Stiles, who has Tony nominations, and Mark Kudish, who has Tony nominations, and Rebecca Naomi Jones, and a bunch of, like, great, great people, Annie Golden. And so we released that as a musical podcast, which is sort of like a radio play. And so people can go to wherever podcasts are found, and they can listen to it. It's 90 minutes, and, you know, it's close your eyes, and it's like seeing a musical movie. And if you don't know where to find podcasts, you can go to bleedinglovemusical.com, and there it'll link you to different places, and you can listen to it there.
And if our listeners would like to see I See You and You See Me, where should they go?
So Queens Theater, if you just go to Queens Theater's webpage, Queens Theater, which is R-E-T-H-E-A-T-R-E.org, there is a link on their front page, and you can see it this Thursday at 7 p.m.
And that's for free, too. We should point that out.
It's free. Yes. That's free. The podcast is free. It's all free. Just, you know, take some art and replenish your soul.
Harris Duran, thank you so much for joining me here this morning on WBAI.
Thank you for having me.
And I should also note, because, you know, I got a preview of this film, there are some recognizable names in there. You will likely recognize James Seol. He was in the recent HBO show, The Flight Attendant. For those fans of The Wire who are listening right now, you will recognize Deirdre Lovejoy, who is in quite a number of those episodes. Also, Khalid Rivera from Pose and The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, among others. These are just some of the actors that you're going to be able to see in this free film. You can go to Queens Theater, and as Harris pointed out, that's R-E at the end, queenstheater.org, to be able to find out more about I See You and You See Me. You have been listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM this morning. I want to thank you so much for making WBAI a part of your day. As you know, each week my co-host David Brand and I alternate, and we bring you guests that you might not hear elsewhere. David's going to be on next week. He is going to have some surprise special guests. I won't reveal them here. You should definitely make a point of following us on Twitter or Facebook, and you'll learn more about who we're going to have coming up. We've talked often about how we can better connect with you, our listeners, because we know you value WBAI, and you've made us a part of your community, and you've become part of our community for years, even decades. So if you do have a chance, in the name of this show, start your day off great. Do something wonderful to help support us. The number to call, it is a new number, which really was an old number, I'm told. But the number to call these days at our call center is 212-209-2950. You can become a BAI buddy in the name of this show, or maybe my other show, Driving Forces, or any program that means something to you. And being a BAI buddy means you just give a sustaining contribution of $10 or $15 or $20 a month, goes right on your credit card. Again, 212-209-2950. I want to thank our engineer, Sean Rhodes, who makes this show happen every week. I also want to thank my guests, Cass Sunstein, author of Liars, Falsehoods, and Free Speech in the Age of Deception by Oxford University Press, Dan Gorodnik, author of Saving Stuyvesant Town, How One Community Defeated the Worst Real Estate Deal in History, published by Cornell University Press, and who you just heard, Harris Duran, director of the new film produced by Queen's Theater, and it's called I See You and You See Me. I will be back this Thursday at 5 o'clock with Driving Forces and my co-host Celeste Katz-Marston. We're going to be joined by author Anne Michaud discussing her book on Melania Trump, and crossing our fingers because tentatively right now, second half of the show, we will have mayoral candidate Andrew Yang joining us. You will want to tune in Thursday at 5 o'clock for Driving Forces. Again, keep us in mind to start your day next Sunday too when David Brand is back here. I want to thank you for tuning in and have a great day.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. CityWatch came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up at 11 o'clock is Radio Free Erin with John McDonough and Maliki McCourt. Please stay tuned.
Greetings. This is Dr. James McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse, family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties, end your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
We're in a unique moment here. It's a moment where we have a chance to actually demonstrate our power.
Imhotep Gary Bird, heard on WBAI Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m.
I learned from Dr. Walter Fauntroy, who fought with Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement, that there were five areas that they identified that they felt politics could control and hit. It was health, housing, education, economics, and social justice. The fact is, WBAI is a nexus for the progressive community to make those changes in all of those areas and has been decade after decade. I say to you again, whose station?
Our station!
Whose control?
Our control!
Long live WBAI.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, April 18th, 2021 at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held by teleconference. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. The access number is 963-003. Again, the call-in number is 623-600-3766. The access number is 963-003. That date is Sunday, April 18th at 1 p.m. Everyone is welcome to call in and attend the meeting.
Thanks to you.
Thank you for thinking of me.
And I thank you.
I
thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys?